each strip of medicine only lasts about 5 days. As he has so little money, it is not possible to buy several strips or packets at a time. Abdul Karim has developed pains in his arms from carrying heavy loads. He feels like crying out in pain, he said. But I must work to buy medicine for my mother. I don't want to die. Ghazal, a six-year-old girl, screams when she hears an explosion or any other loud noise. When a bombardment occurs at night, she insists on sleeping in her father's arms. She is traumatized by how the Zionist regime killed her uncle in the early stages of the current genocidal war by the Zionist regime. Ghazal keeps asking, "Where did they take Uncle Basil when he was sleeping?" In mid-January, the Zionist regime military surrounded with tanks the Khan Yunis school where Ghazal and his family were sheltering. The Zionists ordered everyone to leave the school within 15 minutes. Ghazal's mother said, "We went through the checkpoints and walked for 8 hours, with corpses lying on the ground all along the way." Ghazal said repeatedly as she saw dead bodies, "I don't want to die. I don't want to die like them. I am a child." The Zionist regime troops took Ghazal's father into detention as they went through a checkpoint. Ghazal tried to run after her father, but the Israelis fired shots in the air. Her father was released in April. Ghazal's anxiety remains acute. She has started wetting the bed again. Sometimes she had not done since she was 2. Her mother said, "Ghazal cries when she wakes up, afraid that I will punish her for wetting herself, but I always reassure her." Omar, a 5-year-old, was rescued from under the rubble in February. He's the only surviving member of his family. When he was brought to Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah, doctors decided that he required an arm and leg amputation. As his parents have been murdered, Omar's aunt Maham is now taking care of him. He keeps asking where his mom and dad are. Maham does not know what to tell him. Omar has spoken about how he saw his sister, Yasmin, without a head following the attack on the family. Maham said he is only 5. What did Omar do to those troops? Why have they destroyed his life? For almost 10 months, the Zionist regime has been attacking Gaza. The pain has been horrific for everyone, especially children. Anadolu News Agency wrote, as the Zionist regime rains down death and destruction on Gaza, organizations like Doctors Without Borders have even coined a new term to identify children without surviving family members, WCNSF, Wounded Child, No Surviving Family. All of this is by design and part of the Zionist regime's psychology of occupation, according to Dr. Iman Farajollah, a clinical psychologist and professor of psychology based in California. She told Anadolu, "I think it's really important to understand how the psychology of occupation works. We cannot just only overlook the years of occupation that Palestinians have actually experienced for 75 years. And I think what Israel has done for so many years is basically to create a traumatized nation all through their policies against Palestinians. They are trying to create a traumatized nation that cannot stand up for themselves and cannot actually ask for liberation or self-determination or for their own state." When it comes to the trauma of children in the Gaza Strip, Farajullah explained that they face what is known as complex continuous trauma, a term referring to prolonged and repeated exposure to traumatic events. She said, Palestinian children have been suffering for so many years, generations after generations. The trauma they are experiencing is continuous, 24/7. They are in Gaza, a big jail or open-air prison, and on the top of that, there is continuous bombing all the time. They have no escape. This relentless trauma manifests in different forms, ranging from desperation to impacts on cognitive abilities, she explained. She said, the symptoms that Palestinian children have suffered can be placed in four categories. The first one is behavioral signs, the second cognitive signs, then emotional signs, and the fourth and the last one is the physical signs. She said, they have symptoms like depression and anxiety. They have nightmares when they sleep. They have difficulties to leave the side of their parents or comply with house orders. They have flashbacks all the time, and they wake up in night screaming, and they have avoidance behaviors. These children are living with the constant fear of losing their parents or having something else happen to them. The psychologist said, in terms of their cognitive signs, a lot of them suffer from confusion and lack of concentration. She said many mothers have told her that their child was good at school before, for example, the war of 2014, but after it, because of the trauma, a lot of them lack the ability to succeed in school. The Zionist regime's deadly violence against Palestinians and the brutalities of its ongoing war are psychologically impacting people all around the world, who are seeing a constant stream of graphic images and stories of immense pain and suffering, said Farajullah. She emphasized that second-hand trauma is no different than first-hand trauma. She explained, the way the people in Palestine are being afflicted is, of course, stronger, but people around the world are also being affected, and symptoms like depression, anxiety, stress can occur with all individuals who actually experience secondhand trauma. Watching secondhand trauma constantly live in front of our eyes, it is going to impact us psychologically, physically, and emotionally. There is no doubt in that, and the only escape would be if choose to close our eyes or shut down your TV, your social media, and to isolate yourself. However, I don't think anybody seeing these atrocities and the genocide that is happening in Gaza can close their eyes. All of this is going to affect people in the long run and have a very, very negative effect on their psychology, she warned.
Islamic Republic of Iran's army.
Part 1.
New York, arriving by air for a 2-month visit to the United States.
December 5th, 1955. Mohammad Reza Pahlavi is Iran's Shah, who has gone to visit then-U.S. President Eisenhower. During the meeting, Eisenhower refused to grant a $10 million loan to the Shah. Mohammad Reza got disgruntled and returned to Iran. Eisenhower was sort of the winner of World War II. He passed away only a few weeks before Hitler committed suicide. But Eisenhower left a significant legacy for the next U.S. president. In his first speech after winning the presidential election, he said, "I don't believe there's any region more important than Iran on the world map." Iran possesses oil and is located in a strategic location in the world. We shouldn't create conditions to send Iran back to its distant past and turn it into a military power. We'll be in trouble if Iran's militarism is revived. Go read the country's history to find out what I'm saying. Eisenhower was referring to Iran's history 2,500 years ago. After Eisenhower died, his deputy Harry Truman assumed power, a man who achieved the first atomic bomb in history and killed over 300,000 people in Japan in just 2 days. But he viewed Mohammad Reza and his needs differently.
Ends a 7,000-mile trip from Tehran, where it was sent by the president to bring His Imperial Majesty Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, Shah in Shah of Iran, to Washington. The Shah is cordially welcomed by President Truman and a large party of distinguished officials, including the president's most respected advisors and His Excellency Hussein Allah, Iranian ambassador to the United States. The great gathering assembled to hail the arrival of Iran's youthful Shah, here is the royal visitor officially welcomed to the United States by President Truman.
I'm happy to welcome you to the United States on this, your first visit here. I look forward to your Majesty's visit with great pleasure, and I trust that during its course you may have the opportunity of becoming well acquainted with our country.
I thank you, Mr. President, for your generous welcome. I'm looking forward with the keenest anticipation to all that I have to experience here in the greatest democracies in the free world.
The Shah viewed her trip as the beginning of the change. In 1946, the Shah's twin sister, Ashraf, met Truman on her trip to the U.S. and convinced him to support her brother, the Shah. Truman threatened Stalin, the leader of the Soviet Union, and made Soviet forces put an end to the occupation of Iran's Azerbaijan and restore the separated territory to Iran. The Shah's return to Azerbaijan that had been reclaimed by the army had become a lasting memory of him. It looked like the new U.S. president views things differently from Eisenhower. On January 20, 1949, Truman won the presidential election for a second term. In his speech, he unveiled a principle. The principle had been tipped to make the world undergo a tremendous change. Truman said over half the people in the world live in a very dire situation. They don't have enough food to eat and fall victim to diseases. Their economic life is nomadic and lackluster. Poverty is a problem and threatens everyone, especially prosperous regions. For the first time in human history, he implemented both knowledge and skill to help these people who were going through a lot of suffering. It seemed the U.S. really wanted to make the world a better place to live in. The memory of the atomic bomb of Japan was about to be buried under the propaganda of Truman's Point 4. The Shah thought if he could reinforce the army like his father, he could get closer to the ideal of becoming the absolute power. That's why, in 1949, amid his trip to the U.S. and meeting with Truman, he did his best to persuade him to give Iran financial and military aid. As a first step, Truman convinced U.S. Congress on October 6, 1949, to approve the Mutual Defense Assistance Act and give Iran $27 million in military aid. It means Iran's army that had been ruined during the occupation could be reconstructed. Many years later, Truman's humanitarian image made Mohammad Mossadegh, Iran's then prime minister, to extend his hand to ask for help from Truman, who had a constant smile on his face. Mossadegh stood behind the door in this place for hours so he could meet Truman when he was passing through. Mossadegh was in the midst of a historical battle. Iran's prime minister nationalized the oil industry and cut off Britain's control over Iran's oil. Britain wouldn't stand to see democratic shows of power in its colonies and put a naval siege on Iran. In the first oil sanction in history, all countries were banned from purchasing Iran's oil. Iran would load barrels of oil onto ships, but there were no buyers. Mossadegh planned to sell the oil to Italy. The Rosemary ship was filled with oil barrels, but as soon as it departed from the port, it was confiscated by the British royal vessel. Mossadegh needed strong naval forces, a major force that could stand against powerful British royal forces and escort Iran's oil ships up to their destination. But there were no forces among the Shah's royal forces that could make such a great achievement. So Mossadegh asked Truman for help. Truman gave him a clear answer. The U.S. stance was the same as Britain's. And as a result, the first democratically elected government in Iran's history was toppled by the U.S. orchestrated coup of 1953. The coup was perpetrated by the army. The army was being controlled and guided by the U.S. military advisors according to an idea proposed by Roosevelt and practiced by Truman. They used to call the U.S. military personnel advisors. They had come to Iran to train and manage Iranian forces. Many years later, the U.S. Secretary Department made a mistake and some documents were leaked. According to documents inadvertently leaked by Truman's Presidential Library in 1995, the U.S. and British governments had prepared a plan named Denial Policy, so in case the Soviet Union gains access to the oil resources in West Asia, then it would become operational. The U.S. and Britain would launch nuclear bombs on Iran and Saudi Arabia to cut off the Soviet Union's access to Iran's oil resources. The Anglo-Iranian Oil Company and the U.S.-Saudi Aramco were jointly involved in the plan. The plan was devised in Harry Truman's administration, but it continued during the next three presidents' terms in office. After Truman left office, John F. Kennedy came to power and the situation got more complicated for Mohammad Reza by the day. The Shah was dreaming about establishing a powerful naval and air force, but Kennedy was not interested even in hearing about his fantasies. The Shah would go to the U.S. to inspect American forces' military drills and would watch the U.S. launchers that would blast off missiles into space. He would even inspect the spaceships.
Of Safar is the day of Arba'in, which marks exactly 40 days after Ashura and the heart-rending tragedy of Karbala. Arba'in is a day of pilgrimage to the shrine of Chief of Martyrs, Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, peace be upon him. Pilgrims arrive in Karbala, Iraq, in their millions from all over the world, and many on foot. We here at Arabi English Radio express our heartfelt condolences to all our Muslim listeners on the occasion of Arba'een.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoint on Imam Hussein's uprising and the Arba'een Walk. People from tens of countries participate in Arba'een Valley and they become the guests of the people of Iraq. We should try to strengthen the already firm bonds between Muslim brothers, the bond between Iraqis and non-Iraqis, the bond between Shia and Sunni, and the bond between Arabs, Fars, Turks, and Kurds. These bonds are a source of bliss. They are a sign of divine mercy. The enemy is trying to create discord, but he has failed, and by Allah's favor and grace, he will continue to fail. We, Iran and Iraq, are two nations which are interconnected. Our bodies, our hearts, and our souls are connected together. What has created this connection is faith in Allah and love for Ahlul Bayt, greetings be upon them, and for Hussein ibn Ali, praise be upon him. And by Allah's favor, this will increase on a daily basis. The enemies will hatch plots, but it will be of no avail.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
From the beginning of the Islamic Revolution until today, it has been 40 years that the U.S., its cohorts, its agents, and its mercenaries have been scheming and doing various activities. They spend money, issue threats, and impose sanctions. However, despite their foolish desires, in the past 40 years, the Islamic Republic has changed from a thin sapling to a strong tree, whose root is firmly fixed and its branches reach to heavens. The Holy Quran, chapter 24, verse 14. I hope that by Allah's favor, the slogan that you are chanting against the U.S. and the Zionist regime and against the enemies and the arrogant will be realized in a not-too-distant future. And by Allah's favor, you will succeed in doing that. Once more, I would like to express my gratitude, and I will tell you that the Iranian nation is grateful to you, dear Iraqi brothers, with all its heart. In particular, The people of Iran are grateful to you, owners of Arba'in Mawakib. We are grateful to you from the bottom of our hearts. I would like to end with this couplet by Muntanabi. When you treat an honorable person with respect, you will win his heart.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Doing a song from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. The U.S. keeps claiming progress has been made in talks for a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. At the same time, it keeps funding and arming Israel's war machine against the people of Gaza, and it also helps Tel Aviv maintain and strengthen the all-out siege on the Palestinian territory. Now, alongside the everyday bombings, the weaponized starvation, and the lack of medicine and basic necessities, Gazans face the threat of a polio virus outbreak. With the international community incapable of taking any meaningful action, what options do the Palestinians have but resistance? We'll discuss that more in tonight's Spotlight with our guests. Political analyst and academic Ali Hamia, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. And we also have activist and political analyst Batul Sobeti, joining us from the British capital, London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, welcome to the program, to the both of you. Let's start off with Mr. Hamia in Beirut, and let's begin our discussion with this horrendous, appalling, and gut-wrenching genocide that is going on as we speak. Just last week, a dark milestone was passed with over 40,000 Palestinians, mostly women and children, being slaughtered in cold blood. And of course, when the dust settles, the death toll will definitely be much, much higher. Over 10 months of war crimes, bombings, starvation, sniping, and etc., and the international community has sat idly by as these horrors unfold before our very eyes.
Yes, sir. I would like to start to say that we see that with every visit of U.S. Secretary of State to the area, we see a new massacres committed by the Israeli entity, and we see that they are talking about massacres. They are talking about, we can say, by all means, it's not only massacres, it's ethnic cleansing. It's like more than Holocaust. It's a certified Holocaust that the Israeli is committing in Gaza and in West Bank also. We have to mention West Bank, what's going on, because we have so many detainees, or POW as they want to call them, every day that we have in West Bank, more than 5,000 now detainees in the hand of the Israeli soldiers. They are attacking, as we see, the infrastructure everywhere in Gaza, putting like a wall of pressure against Hamas, because they cannot make like a confrontation against the military wings of Hamas in Gaza. They attack the civilians, destroying hospitals, schools, water tanks. Even they attack the UNRWA positions and centers. So they will not. They want to make not only to kill the people by bombs, but to kill people also not to have enough medication and treatment in hospitals, because most of hospitals they have lack and shortage of fuel, doctors, and equipments. So the Israelis trying to not only to make a displacement of the Palestinian, but it's a certified Holocaust is done by the Israelis. They have to mention also that the Israelis now are doing what they've been told or supported by the American. The American is supporting the Israelis to attack, and from one hand, and the other hand, the American are declaring negotiations once in Doha, the second time in Cairo, and all those is maneuvering, right. And they are trying to distract him the whole world that they are going to have a ceasefire or so, but it's like some kind of conditions, Israeli conditions, by the time, American time.
Right, and Ms. Sobeiti, I want you to address the issue of the inaction of the international community, which I mentioned earlier to Mr. Hamia. And of course, the UN, it says that 90% of the Gaza population is now displaced. Schools and shelters housing displaced families in Gaza, they continue to be targets of the Israeli regime. It's also using starvation and hunger as a weapon of war. How is fighting Hamas and the resistance in any way tied to inducing famine and hunger on Palestinian children in Gaza? The Israeli onslaught and massacre, it was never just against the resistance. It was a genocide against all of the people in Gaza. Do you agree with that?
It's exactly as you say. The war is not against the resistance per se. It's against the collective Palestinian people, because the people themselves are the resistance. You know, just identifying as a Palestinian, you are condemned to death. The contention of the Israeli occupation entities with the entire existence of the Palestinian people, because the Israeli settlers know they are not the default, and they have essentially stolen this land in which its people were displaced in 1948. So Netanyahu's strategy for continuing the war is really just to create the most unbearable conditions for the Palestinian families. I mean, you mentioned the targeting of children. That's the most precious thing to anyone is their children. So they want to really break the Palestinian will through the excruciating emotional pain of watching your children get blown to pieces, so they can essentially push for Palestinians to leave, the same as what happened in the Nakba, expulsion and population transfer. There's no other solution that the Israeli occupation entity is willing to accept. Doesn't want a two-state, certainly doesn't want a one-state. It cannot re-besiege Gaza with the resistance standing stronger than it was pre-October the 7th. Ultimately, these past 10 months have really just shown the dirty face of the capitalist structure ruling the world, and have removed those masks of deception. Such a scale of atrocity has not happened since World War II. You know, all conventions and agreements to prevent such a genocide from happening have been shown to be complete lies in front of the real test that we're seeing materially on the ground. You know, the formation of the entity in 1948 and everything by extension linked to it is the biggest shame for the world, because the world superpowers conspired to uproot the Palestinians and the world turned a blind eye. So you mentioned the international community here. The hope comes from the resistance front globally as well. That is not the governments, but it's the people of the nations rising against this entity and saying enough is enough in all forms, from divestment campaigns in universities to shutting down weapons factories to challenging in the workplace, fighting the disinformation war and the rest of it.
And staying with you, Ms. Sawedi, because Mr. Hamia he spoke about the issue of the peace talks. We know the diplomatic efforts have been ongoing over the past months to establish a ceasefire in Gaza and exchange of prisoners between Israel and Hamas. A deal, however, is yet to be reached over the constant changing of Israeli demands. With regards to the recent negotiations, sources and also interviewed Hamas officials say Israel has changed its conditions over the last minute. Now, Hamas has always stated that it's committed to the UN-backed proposal that was agreed to in early July. And the latest US-backed text that was conveyed at the end of the Doha talks, again, they aligned with the Israeli demands. Why does Israel, along with the US, continue to put up new roadblocks and obstacles in these talks?
His ending is linked with the end of the war, and he knows this very well. This war should have been stopped months ago. I don't think anyone could have predicted it for going on for this long, simply because the Israeli occupation entity is shooting itself in the foot, and it's fragmenting more and more with time, and it's accumulating defeat. We know that Netanyahu is elongating the war because his whole survival is linked to it. For that reason, even Gallant came out and challenged Netanyahu's bravery for continuing the war at the expense of the Israeli occupation entity. So really, Netanyahu himself has become an existential threat to the entity. He's also hoping and betting on the fact that they might discover tunnel networks, locate Yahya Sinwar, or achieve something by luck, since the entity hasn't achieved anything yet in these past 10 months. And that is with the weakest link of the resistance axis on the ground, and that is Hamas. You know, if you consider compared to the whole resistance axis. And in addition, Netanyahu wants to continue to create the most unbearable conditions for the Palestinians. Also, there's another perspective here, and that is he might want to also toughen the Israeli society up. You know, traditionally, the occupation entity is a society of luxury. They aren't used to war, and he wants to put the reality in front of them that as a society now, they are fighting a war of existence and survival. And so Netanyahu is resorting to the utmost degree of delay because he knows that America will not abandon the Israeli occupation entity because it is their project, and they won't allow their project to be defeated at the hands of the resistance axis.
Ali Hamia, you mentioned the U.S. Secretary of State earlier, Antony Blinken. He's issued a warning calling the ongoing Gaza ceasefire talks possibly the quote-unquote last opportunity to secure a hostage deal. Last opportunity indeed before Israel kills more captives by recklessly bombing Gaza. That matter itself of the captives dying under Israeli bombs has been a major point of discontent from within the Israeli public itself.
We are talking about a negotiation that was born dead, and we see that the American supportive of Israel by not using the 2,000-pound bomb, but they are allowed to use 1,000-pound bomb. So it means kill, but not 200 people at the same time. You can kill 100 people and massacre 100 people, 120, 150, but don't do it so widely. I think about what's going on, the Americans are, as we know, they ship more than 450 shipments of arms, weapons, also ammunition, military equipments, even the F-35, 40 of them were shipped to the Israeli entity. We are talking about the last chance given by the American for the negotiation to be a success. I think they are bluffing, they are lying. They are trying to put the Israeli conditions. When we are talking about only ceasefire and exchange of POW, it means this is what Israel wants. But the main goal for Hamas is to withdraw first and ceasefire, withdraw, and then we talk about the exchanging of POWs. So beside that, all what the American try to put on the table, It's not true. It's a big lie. They give the Israelis more than 10 months to destroy Gaza, to demolish the buildings, to erase families from registers. And they are trying now to appear as they are mediators. I think from the beginning, they called themselves, the American called themselves, negotiators, but not mediators. They called themselves negotiators, and they call the Arab countries as mediators. So there is differences between negotiator, which can impose the conditions, and the mediator only as they take the message and try to make compromise and put pressure against the Palestinian to accept the Israelis' conditions. I don't think this will go anywhere. I think the negotiation after what's happening between the Israelis and the American and the crowding and pushing with their fleets against Gaza on the Mediterranean Sea and new aircraft carriers, they don't want this ceasefire to happen as the Palestinian, for the relaxation of Palestinian. They are doing that because Israeli is in deep, in the corner. They don't know what to do because they most of their military power are now collapsing. If we are talking about the armed forces, the infantries, they are trying to do their best by the air force. This is the best for them to do, killing, committing massacres, and they have the full support of the United States. And even though when Biden declared on 31st of May about the UN resolution 2735 for ceasefire, the Israeli right. did not implement any or accept any of those conditions, and they pushed the ball on the hands of Hamas to say that Hamas did not accept it.
Sure. Ms. Soueti, the pro-Palestine demonstrations in the United States, they came into the spotlight again during the Democratic National Congress in Chicago. Give us your overall assessment of these demonstrations. With all this anger at home, how come American politicians won't even second-guess their support for Israel?
The opposition against the Israeli occupation entity very naturally is becoming greater with time as we're witnessing all these crimes in front of us. But it hasn't reached the point of changing American policies yet. Administrations in the West will take this opposition into consideration, though, I think, especially in the long run. It is not in the interest of the Western establishments to continue supporting the Israeli occupation entity, given the West's need for the Israeli occupation entity itself will naturally and incrementally be reduced with time because the entity has proven to be a sheer and utter failure. So my assessment is that the entity naturally with time will match to shrink its true size. It cannot be given a role greater than what it can perform competently. Whilst the occupation entity under Netanyahu rejects Palestinian control over Gaza and seeks direct control, America and certain Western powers are seeking a two-state solution. If you consider where we were and where we are, compare the fact that just a few years ago, you know, the Abraham Accords that Trump was pushing forward, which the American establishment accepted, denied and rejected the idea of Palestinian statehood. But the reality of October the 7th and that shift in power balance has forced the two-state solution to be put on the table and the Palestinian file to be recognized and spoken of again after it's been, you know, placed on the shelf for all of these decades. And so America's focus is really on the political settlement. Ultimately, that is what it wants. America wants to see an end to this war. It wants to see a ceasefire, although it is not pressuring the Israeli occupation entity right now, in particular given the fact that it is election period. But ultimately, the American strategy includes the formation of a new government in Gaza that is Western friendly. Of course, when we say a two-state, quote, quote unquote, it's not Palestinian sovereignty and defense that we're talking about over here. We're talking about a Western friendly entity, ultimately because it's in America's interest before it's in the Israeli occupation's interests to defeat Hamas. They want to weaken the Gazan resistance and continue with targeted and limited operations on the ground because the war has been a sheer and utter failure. So I think with time, American support will shrink for the occupation entity. But right now, especially right now in times of crisis, America cannot but protect the Israeli occupation entity because Israel is an American project first and foremost. It cannot allow its project to basically collapse at the hands of the resistance. And accountability for the failures of Israel in defeating the Gazan resistance will ultimately happen post-war.
Ali Hamia, the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, and Israel have been trading fire since the beginning of the onslaught on Gaza. The tensions have severely escalated recently as Israel awaits Hezbollah's response to the assassination of its top commander, Fuad Shukr. How do you assess the heightened tensions along the southern Lebanese border? Do you think that it can spiral into a broader regional war? And can the Israelis deal with the consequences of a full-blown war with Hezbollah and the entire resistance front in the region?
We see that the Israeli army is about 650,000 soldiers. We have about 175 active, and we have they have about 500, more than 500 or 475 reserve. And they cannot split their active army between Gaza and the West Bank and Lebanon. What we see that up to now, the resistance from Lebanon, they are bombarding the Israelis by conventional weapons, missiles, old missiles. We are talking about 122 millimeters and also 107 millimeters. We are talking about some snipers. We are talking about Burkan, Farak 1, Almas 1, 2, and 3. So they still did not use the strategic missiles against the Israelis, which is hidden just to bombard in case we have the war expanding. They will hit directly Tel Aviv and Gush Dan. So the Israeli knows, the Israelis know about by now that up to now, the Lebanese resistance only put the Israeli in blind, destroying and defeating most of espionage towers, balloons and drones, UAVs, and even they use their some kind of air defenses against fighter jets, Israeli fighter jets. But up to now, did not use the full scale weapons against the Israelis. So I think if the Israeli entity wants to expand the war, it will go for regional war. Up to now, first of all, the American wants this war to be happen, but at the beginning. But now the American are breaking this decision into two phases. I think between the Israelis and the American, they have different policy, but the same goal against the Palestinian and against Lebanon. And the timing is not yet arrived to have a full-scale war against Lebanon. They know for sure that if American or Israeli entity attack Lebanon at full-scale war or big condensed air raids against Lebanon, I think most of the resistance axis will interfere, and we will have a big regional war may extend to be connected with the war between Ukraine and Russia, because between both of those fronts that we have the same enemy. Maybe we have different doctrines, but we have the same enemy that they are fighting against the Russians, and we saw what happened in Kursk, and the same enemy that they are fighting against us. And after the Yemenis humiliate the American Navy in the Red Sea and even in the Arab Sea or in Eden Gulf, we see okay. that they have more encouragement for the Russian maybe to help more.
Ms. Obeiti, the Israeli military, it has suffered heavy casualties in Gaza, where we can see the resistance remains strong despite the months of the Israeli aggression there. Since late October, when the Israeli invasion of Gaza started, the regime has acknowledged the death of over 330 of its troops in the ground fighting. Of course, the Palestinian resistance groups say Israel is underreporting its casualties and the actual figure is much higher. So the Israelis said they want to destroy Hamas, which they haven't. They wanted to release the captives, which has not happened. They said that the war would make Israel safer, which has not happened as well. Has this military campaign in Gaza been a huge failure across the board for the Israelis?
Absolutely. As Army Reserve General Yitzhak Rake stated, you know, the entity will collapse within a year if war against the Gazan and Lebanese resistance continues. And he literally verbatim stated that Israel is sinking deeper into the Gazan mud, losing more and more soldiers. The resistance now is at a point where it was much stronger than it were pre-October the 7th. The current fragmentation within the entity has reached a stage where it is on the verge of a civil war. There is not a single point of unity within the entity, even with their master America. So it's become clear that the entity has not achieved any single one of its declared goals. This has been compounded by the cowardice that the entity suffers with direct confrontation on the ground. And this ultimately is a reflection of the broader weakness of the Israeli settler society. It's a society of land investment. It's not a society of war. They have no deep affiliation to the stolen lands, and most settlers have alternative countries from where they've come from. So the costs of the war have also been mammoth, and there's a real threat to their production and service sectors overall across the entity. This is compounded with the social divisions that we see amongst the population on major issues. And if you consider the fact that the occupation regime is now begging for the West to form a coalition to protect it, you know, to protect it against Iran, to protect it against Lebanon, as though the primary function of the West is to protect the Israeli occupation entity. Rather, the Israeli occupation entity was created to protect Western interests. And America is now bringing all of its forces and all of its power to the region to intercept the incoming drones and missiles. This also shows you how strong the Iranian deterrence is. The fact that half of America's warships and fleets and fighter jets have to be brought to the region, standing on its toes, not knowing when Iran is going to throw those missiles into the entity, is enough proof about the strength of the deterrence of the resistance axis.
All right, thanks a lot. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Ali Hamia, academic and political analyst, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut, activist and political analyst, Batul Sobeiti, joining us from the British capital, London. Thank you for your comments, and also special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.